Hi everyone, my name is Jared Lank, and this is the Center for Tribes podcast. Before we get started with today's episode, I just want to note that this episode is a continuation of the conversation Tay and I were having in episode 1. So if you haven't had a chance to listen to that yet, I would highly encourage you to start there first. Episode 1, along with all other content and tools discussed in this episode, will be listed in the show notes and are available on our website, tribalinformationexchange.org. In our continued conversation, Tay and I discussed the tools in a recent 3-part webinar series they developed in collaboration with the Center for Tribes. The name of the webinar is Decolonizing the History of the Gender Binary. It equips professionals in the tribal child welfare field with practical, empathetic approaches to supporting gender-diverse Indigenous youth. We at the Center for Tribes hope you enjoy this conversation with Tay and encourage you to watch the recorded 3-part webinar series if you haven't already. Thanks again for listening, and we hope you enjoy this episode. So I want to kind of move the conversation into how you approached part 3 of the webinar series, and it, you know, centering and celebrating global gender diversity with examples. And also, I think it's really important the way you wrapped up the series with focusing on joy, right? Focusing on the positive, because, you know, kind of building off of part 2, the heavy and complex, nuanced substance matter of the history and the way to approach this work can often lead to conversations around all of it being, you know, for lack of a better term, this kind of like uphill kind of struggle to continue to do this, to show up and do the work. But I don't think that is the whole picture. I think that inside of this, there's a lot of room for joy. And I think that there's a lot of examples of joy. And I think it's really important when you're teaching people about these things to represent both of those things equally, right? You need to give highlighting examples of joy and celebration and excellence, right? Not just the hard and the negative and the problem, right? You can see the solution too. And you can also leave with the action items, and you can leave with this positive effect that you see. This is why the hard work pays off. This is why this work is important, right? So I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about your decision to end on a high note with joy, but also on an international level. I think that it's really important to talk about the global perspective you also bring to centering that joy.
Yeah, I think when I do this work, I find that there's a lot of misconceptions. But sort of like maybe the two largest misconceptions I run into is one, that I'm trying to like destroy gender, that I'm trying to like degender everything, make everything like gender neutral, or even conform to a different set of gender rules and stereotypes. You know, I usually bring up the example of like, okay, everyone's going to be called Susan and we're all going to wear white robes and like all do the same thing. And that's not my intention at all. It's quite literally the exact opposite. It's about joy. It's about celebration. It's about finding that uniqueness, that individuality in all of us and celebrating it. It's about pluralism, really, in its highest form. So it's quite the opposite of like narrowing everyone down just to be all neutral and the same. And I think that also fits in with this sort of like preconception that like, you know, trans story, two-spirit story, non-binary story is a tragic one. Like, innately, it's tragic. Like, you can't even talk about the community unless you're talking about violence and tragedy. And we're people, you know what I mean? Like, we experience all of the emotions, including joy. And I think it's not even about, like, ending on a high note. I think it's about ending with a holistic picture. It's about ending with a broad take on people who are just people living their lives, on communities that are out there just trying to live and take care of each other and like do the thing. And like, if we're not talking about that joy, if we're not talking about that celebration, we're doing the community a disservice. I think we're doing all of us a disservice, because again, the point isn't to get to a new set of rules where everything is like gender neutral. The point is to get to where everyone is thriving, to where everyone has joy, to where everyone is celebrated for uniquely who they are. And so I want to get rid of this, like, we can only talk about trans people in the past tense or in a violent tense or in like another statistic tense, because like we're still people. Like, I, you know, I like to play video games. I like to go on long walks on the beach. Like, I am a full person. My singular identity does not define the breadth of who I am. And even if you want to do it, there's complexity in that. Like, I experience trans joy. I love who I am. I love my gender identity. I love my gender expression. It's the world that has a problem with me. It's society that has a problem with me. Like, our communities know how to come together and celebrate ourselves, and there's joy in that. And that's the point, is to have that broad view and to spread that joy and celebration for all of us to thrive. And so that's how I want to sort of end it. Again, not necessarily on that high note, but again, recognizing that complexity, that broadness of experience that does contain joy. And that is the ultimate goal that I want us all to get to, you know?
Oh, I love that. Yeah, man, this is so good. This is great. You know, and I think that there's something in here that about the negativity in particular that's just so important to touch on. And again, it circles back to a lot of this conversation about humanizing, is that focusing on negativity feels in a way dehumanizing, right? To your point, it's very much like, this is, you can only be painted in this certain light, right? It is
absolutely
kind of stripping away the power of the community and of the people in this like group to say, you know, this is how you are portrayed in society. And I think that it's really important for there to be the positive aspect of, you know, any type of culture in the world, any type of community in the world, because like you said, it's a core component of being a human being. Joy is like, I would argue, the definitive thing that makes us all human. Laughing and sharing joy are things that are what build community. It's like what makes you a human being. And I think that by removing that and kind of just focusing on the oppressed and negative aspects of a people is very much a way to dehumanize, you know? So I like that how you're approaching this, because at the end of the day, it is about human beings, right? It's just about respect for human beings. And I think that is, I really enjoyed the global examples too, because I think that, again, very much parallel with indigenous work, is that indigeneity is a global human thing.
Yeah.
It is very much not just a North American thing, is not just a South American thing. You know, the indigenous cultures are a global thing. And I love the interconnectedness of indigenous cultures. I really love the through lines and the connecting threads, I guess you could say, that weave us all together in that way. Even though we're so, as indigenous people, our cultures are so connected to place and land, right? Like, we're so very much a reflection of that place.
Yeah.
And who we are as a people. Like, I think that it's important to include global examples of everything. And I liked how you incorporated not only examples of like Two-Spirit everywhere, but it was like very indigenous focused, and I love that. I thought it was like so good, because it's like compounding positivity. It was great.
Yeah. For sure. And I think that, like, to go back to your point about sort of like dehumanizing people,
right?
I think, gosh, is that just like another colonial trap that
mm-hmm.
white folks have been doing to indigenous folks, are, you know what I mean? And so it's very much so an indigenous narrative as well, right? That you can't talk about indigenous folks unless you're talking about the Trail of Tears, unless you're talking about the 1700s, the 1600s, the 1800s. Like, there's this narrative of at the heart of indigenality as tragic. as like, that's where we're frozen in time. And it's like, y'all, we're not. Like, hello. Like, me and Jared are here right now talking, having a good time, finding joy. We are still here, you know, but they want to stick us in that trap of history. Like, nope, you're stuck right here in this tragic myth because we don't want folks to be thinking about you today and the joy and the action that you could be doing to sort of see a new tomorrow. And I think that does connect us across the globe. And I do also love, like, it feels weird talking about my work. Like, oh, I love it. Like, it's a little, I don't want to bring in that ego here. But yet, that it's intentional. It's intentional to show that indigenous global perspective. And in all of those videos, there was a lot of things in common. But the two core is that they're affected by colonization and the gender binary, but they're still able to find joy and celebration beyond that, as they always have. You know, like, again, one of the very first things we do in the very first series, right, is talk about this myth that being trans, that being non-binary, that being two-spirit, gender expansiveness, gender diversity as a whole is new. It's a contemporary idea. It's a phase. It's hip with the kids. And it's literally not. It's literally the exact opposite, that it was colonization and white supremacy that forced that box. Traditional teaching across the globe speaks to gender expansiveness, to gender diversity, and in a way that's not tragic, in a way that is uplifted, that is affirmed, that's joyous, that saw those folks at the center of their communities, you know? And I just I love having that joy, but also that in sort of indigenous global perspective of, like, we've always been here and we're still here now. We're still experiencing that pain, but we're still experiencing that joy as well. So I appreciate that you noticed that intentionality around a global joy and a global storytelling perspective.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think it really speaks to indigenous resiliency, right? Like, to your point, it's a shared experience that we all have been, you know, the truth is we've been inextricably changed by this process of being colonized. Yeah. It's been put on us, but we are still here and we've remained resilient through it. Those things that have occurred on a, you know, context to context scenario, right? Like, in an individualistic way, are shared across the indigenous diaspora in a way that I think is really powerful, because it connects us in a way I don't think was ever intentioned for us in this process of being colonized, right? Like, I don't think that anyone would ever expect that we would find strength in our relatability in that way. And to your point, I think that I really like the term you use, tragic myth, right? Because I think that that really speaks to the intentionality of how to portray our people and indigenous people in a modern context, right, is that we should be looking at them as this oppressed type, right, of this, how could they possibly be happy? And when you actually go hang out with Native people, you find out, like,
we're awesome.
we're pretty happy. And we're, like, doing pretty good. So I just feel like, you know, that positivity and joy and celebrating that is so critical. I think that that's very much like humor and happiness and laughter and joy and positivity are what that is, the thing that allowed us to be where we are today. Like, that is our tool for resiliency. You know, it's how we connect. It's who, it's like how we persevere, right? Yeah. It's to laugh in the face of opposition and say, like, you can't dull my shine. You know, and I think that's really great. I think that, you know, it was a great way to wrap the webinar substance matter so that it doesn't feed into those tragic myths that you talked about. And I think that that's incredibly powerful and also is something that is very normal in indigenous knowledge transmission and knowledge sharing.
Well, I was just going to say, and I think that, like, you know, it was very intentional for me to present this material from an indigenous perspective, because I am Indigenous, so literally everything will be from that perspective.
Right.
But without having to name it.
Right.
Like, I didn't want to have to stop every 5 minutes to be like, Indigenous people do X, Y, Z, and Indigenous people would view it like this.
Right.
Like, true intersectionality, true, you know, perspective of culture is baked in inherently to the thing itself, you know? And so sharing those examples, sharing my own stories, watching those videos, hearing from Two-Spirit folks, that's how we did it without having to be like hitting folks like over the face with it, because we shouldn't have to, right? Yeah. We are our own people, and this is a story of our people, you know? Right. I don't have to tell you that every 2 minutes.
Yeah, I love that. And I feel like, you know, the like exposition only serves purposes in like Hollywood movies. Like, it doesn't need to be, you know, like it, you don't need, like you said, you don't need to like be so like in Indigenous cultures. This is how we do this thing. Yeah, I love that. I just think it's so true because it's so normal, you know, for us. And I feel like, again, for the people working, you know, it's really a unique thing for the work that we do at the center is that I think as an Indigenous person and working with other Indigenous people, I have this assumption that a lot of the people working with the tools that we create on the Universal team are Indigenous.
Yeah.
But in my experience, there's a number of people that are not Indigenous working in tribal child welfare. And I think it's so cool to see non-Indigenous folks not only, you know, come into this work for, you know, the people and the culture, but they also like embrace the culture. Like, I've seen people that are non-Indigenous come in and fully, they have such a good perspective of indigeneity and of tribal communities and the specificity of that. And I just feel like, you know, webinars like this and like this type of training just really reinforce that idea that it's a reciprocal thing, that it is not mutually exclusive that it only has to be Indigenous people doing this work. It's an Indigenous epistemology, right? It's the inclusion of Indigenous knowledge to say, like, you know, there's a different way to go about this. And I think, you know, our people know a little bit about it, so we could tell you all about it, you know? And I think that that pushes this idea forward that we, you know, the pluralistic society, right? Like, indigeneity can be a part of this. It can be, there can be an equality here where we're represented in this way that we traditionally haven't been. And I think there's a strong reception there. I think that even outside of the work we do at the center, I think that this type of training and this type of work informs the entire industry, right? The entire field can be informed by this epistemology and this approach. And it's so normal to us, but I see people that are non-Indigenous, you know, working with this stuff for the first time, and they're like, this is profound. Like, this is incredibly impactful to me. And I love that.
Yeah. And I think, Jerry, when we talk again about, you know, history either being written for us or us writing our own history, is that our culture is being assimilated into white culture every day with or without us.
Yes.
You know what I mean? Like, Maslow's hierarchy of needs is from the Blackfoot Nation.
Right.
Restorative justice, which is a buzzword everywhere, is a very Indigenous perspective. And it's
absolutely.
Like, you know, if we're not here talking about it, they're just going to slap a white name on it anyways and like claim it as their own, you know?
Right,
so like,
right,
why
right,
not
right.
be a part of that story?
Right.
And I will also say, maybe I shouldn't say this because this would take us, this is a different podcast and down a different route, but I'm really happy to hear you talk about non-Indigenous folks in this work because I am oftentimes dealing with allies. I'm oftentimes dealing with sort of the non-folks, like the outside of community folks. And when I'm in community spaces, like, it's joyous and like it's fun and it's awesome, but there's some tricky stuff we deal with, like, as folks, like, in community. And I think recognizing blood quantum versus like traditions and association and teaching is a very sensitive subject that we need to toe very, very lightly in, because so many folks are at direct opposite ends of the spectrum, and it's so heated. Like, there's not a whole lot of middle ground there. Like, you really got to be on one side or the other. And that just, like, really terrifies me, because I just feel like that's a colonial tactic. That's, like, like, pitting us against each other, when really, like, we should be coming together and having a conversation, and all of us engaging in this work in ways that feel good to us, and figuring that out as a community, and not necessarily being like, this is in community work, you cannot be here, you know?
Right.
So, maybe we'll just leave it there. I don't know how you feel about that, but.
No, but I love that. I think that you're touching on a really important point in all of this work, is that, you know, it's group effort to figure out how to move the work forward to help people. And I think that the cornerstone of that topic is very much, what are the specific different circumstances that require different types of inputs, right? Like you said, being in community, dealing with very specific community specific problems. What does that look like for someone that's not a part of that community to come in and try to fix those problems, right? What does that look like when someone tries to come in and offer a solution, but say that person that's maybe not Indigenous and not a part of that community, that hasn't done any of this type of work or any decolonial work, like any of that, right? What is that process looking like, and what's the outcome of that versus someone from the community or an Indigenous person that's not from the community, right? There's all these different silos that exist. And I think that silo is a good word for it, because we are very much inside of these schools of thought. And it's so hard, like, again, tying it back into what you brought up earlier, Tay, you know, we're attached to our perspective, right? We're very much attached to that. We're very much like, nah, this is the way it is. You know, this is how we got to do it, yada, yada. And then, you know, someone else comes in and it's like, I don't even know what you're talking about. So it's like, but that can be powerful, right? Yeah. Because it changes how we approach problem solving. And I think that, you know, not to be cheesy about it, but the way you approached this topic with this webinar series, I feel like is a great example of how to level out this understanding at the beginning. Like you said, we were in webinar mode, right? So we didn't talk to the audience at all. We didn't get to do a survey to say at the beginning of this, like, how many of you are from an Indigenous community? Yeah. How many of you are non-Indigenous? How many of you are Indigenous? How many of you are new to the job? How many of you have done this for 30 years? Yeah. You know, we have no clue, really. You know, approaching it from saying, like, okay, well, what are the truths? What are the baselines that we can approach this from? And how can we serve it in a utilitarian way, right? Yeah. But not in a way that's this systemic, help the most with the most type of approach that we often talk about, saying it has blind spots, right? It's more so that we're looking at it from a rising tide lifts all boats, right?
Absolutely.
And I think that is extremely powerful. I'm wondering if you have any action items or next steps for people after they do this webinar, right? Like, so they've been equipped with this knowledge and they've listened to this podcast to this point, and they're ready to go. They want to start implementing, right? Do you have anything that you could share, any tips or suggestions for people on how to approach the work without the tool there, right? Now that you're self-reliant on this knowledge you've gained, what does that next step look like, and what's a good next step, and what's that feel like?
Well, I think that there's some very tangible next steps, and I think that y'all are providing one of them, right? So even just being a part of this sort of like community debriefing space, however y'all are calling it, I think is an important next step, because I think bring together folks who have done this series and talk about it, debrief it, pick it apart, talk about how it landed with you. What were the good parts that felt good to you? What were the parts that felt really uncomfortable to you? And all of those are important to like recognize and to talk about and see. So I think one, going to that group that y'all are planning is a perfect next step. Two, I would say, you know, those tip sheets, use them. Like, so oftentimes it's like a cool thing to maybe look at during the webinar or maybe the next day, and then it just goes into some like email folder to die. And like, consider these like living documents.
Yeah.
Like, really intentionally come back to them, read them, do that action plan, And, you know, that action plan for me is always changing. You know, like I do that action plan yesterday. It's probably going to look drastically different from me doing that action plan a month from now.
Absolutely.
And so I think revisiting those are really, really important. And then I think, like, just don't stop learning. Like, find out new stories, new folks doing this work, new materials. I love documentaries. There's so many amazing documentaries out there, you know? Go out there and watch Exterminate All the Brutes on HBO. Go out there and watch. Oh, it's so good. And we can really talk about, which we kind of are right now, but I love how Raoul Peck ends that series with this question of, it's not knowledge we lack. And as someone who, like, watched that series, who I guess I would consider myself having a deep knowledge and understanding of white supremacy, of oppression, one, was floored about how they presented that material, but two, that phrase got me to my core. It's not knowledge we lack. And right. I think, folks, if you're out there listening to this and you are part of this series, I think, honestly, ask yourself a question of, like, am I all that surprised? Did I hear things that, like, truly surprised me? Or did I just hear things phrased in a good way that was easily digestible and palatable, and now I understood it a little bit better, but there really wasn't a surprise? Because I think, ultimately, I don't know if it's the knowledge that we're lacking. I think it's the action that we're lacking. And I think that, like, right back to your question, that's what I'm hope folks, like, don't lose track of, is that keep learning, find new resources, do that action plan, seek out new media. And I think when you do that, there's a point where, at least for me, I'll use I statements, where my critical thinking skills show up maybe even far too much, where now I'm like questioning everything. And then I start doing learning automatically on my own. So a prime example of this for me is I'm really trying hard to not do sort of a gun language or ableist language in my vocabulary, in my sentences, in my emails. And it's to a point now where when I type something out and I'm proofreading it, I'm so much better at going, oh, wait, I just learned this. The prime example yesterday, I used the term deadline. Oh, hey, we have a deadline for this project. And I was like, wait, hold on. Pump the brake, ask why, prime with intention. Where does that come from? And I Googled it. That's all it took, was a fast 10-second Google to be wow, that, like, legit comes from a really scary, problematic place where it's literally about prisoners being shot. Like, it was literally a deadline. And so I changed it to due date.
Right.
And that, I think, seems so small to some people, because that whole thing played out in probably about 30 seconds of me writing an email going, oh, that's a weird word. Let me Google it. Oh, let's not use that word. I'll use due date.
Yeah.
But that's the action. You know, it doesn't have to be this huge thing. It's about critically thinking, pausing, questioning why, finding out that information, and then doing the action to change it. And sometimes it's as simple as changing a word in an email.
I just want to focus on one part in there that you really brought up that I think is important to talk about a little bit. Because I also am going through the same thing where I'm trying to really approach things with nonviolent communication, and I'm trying not to use gendered statements, right? And I'm trying to unlearn these things, and it's incredibly hard because they're so in my psyche, like, and I didn't choose for them to be there. You know, I just adopted them. I grew up in a environment where these were just, everybody was saying these things and doing these things, and now I'm taking that approach, right? You know, the ableist things and ableist terminology, right? Like, I try to approach it very honestly with myself and give myself the grace to say, like, yeah, got that wrong, gotta not do that, because I have to catch it, right? And because if I'm not actively doing it, I miss it. And I don't even know it. Like, there's so many terms, like you said, that are based in, like, war language, right? And violent communication, and I just try not to do that. But what I'm getting at is, how would you tell people, you know, approaching this work to approach not failure, but getting it wrong and while you're trying, right? Like, what are some tools people can use to say, I know I've accidentally done these things and I'm trying to change course here and not do them anymore, but I inevitably, maybe I misgendered someone. Maybe I am using gendered language in a way that's inappropriate and I didn't know that and I keep slipping up, right? Do you have any advice for people that are engaging with that personal work to try to change their vernacular around everyday conversation and these kind of tendencies to gender things, to misgender people or assign genders to people in conversation? Do you have any suggestions for how to approach that? I know we went over that in part one, but I just think it's such an important topic. Yeah. Oh, you do. Oh, great. I love that. Great.
Yeah. Well, Jared, I think first of all, I would say it's very important to try.
Yeah.
Because I think sometimes folks who are, they want to be allies. They have so much like good intention. Mm-hmm. They may even be practicing that sort of like slow down and prime with intention.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think sometimes for folks, there's this fear of getting it wrong. There's this fear of doing harm.
Mm-hmm.
So they don't try.
Yeah.
That equals inaction, right? And like you said earlier, inaction is action.
Oh, yeah.
Right? And so, which is so funny because it ends up being sort of the same end result of someone who maybe doesn't have good intentions. Like it's still the same thing you're coming to.
Mm.
And so the first thing I think folks need to recognize is that you just got to lean into it.
Mm.
You got to lean into the uncomfortable. You got to lean into making mistakes. You got to lean into that liminal space that none of us are perfect.
Mm.
We're all going to get this wrong from time to time. But it's the trying that matters. So I think the first step is you got to try.
Mm-hmm.
The second step is knowing how to do a good apology. You know, part one, one of my favorite parts of that is doing the apology A versus the apology B.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, a good apology is, gosh, right back to Willie Littlechild. It's an awareness of the past.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, hey, I know I did this. Right.
Yeah.
It's being aware, an acknowledgement of the harm that it caused. I know that like those are not your pronouns, and I know it matters. An atonement, like I'm going to try harder. And then action, like I have a pronoun practice partner. I'm going to do little things every day to try to get better at it. And I think then, period, ending that apology. And as I hope we know, any good apology is changed behavior.
Yes.
Is going out and actually doing those things. Because I think an apology, just like knowledge, is the first step, but it doesn't mean anything unless you actually do something about it.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And so, okay. So then one is to try. Two is to have a good apology when you mess up, because we all make mistakes.
Mm.
Three is to practice. I mean, you have to be doing those actions, no matter how small they are.
Mm.
You know, I talk about having a pronoun practice partner, and I know to some it sounds so ridiculous, but it's like a small thing that you can do to have accountability.
Absolutely.
Just to have an accountability partner, you know, people in your life who are like-minded, who are also trying, who you can be like, hey, did you know that I Googled what deadline means the other day? And this is what it means? That like, I've been using the term brainstorm, and that's really problematic, and it's really about idea generation. Having that community of like-minded people who are trying and practicing and doing those actions and sharing sort of that communication, I think, is the next step and is really, really important. And so I think that those are like maybe three low-hanging fruit, important things for folks to realize. And Jared, do we have time? Can I tell a quick story?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. I would love that.
Okay. I want folks to know, and you can hear it from me, as someone who is queer, who is trans, who is two-spirit, who has been doing this work for over a decade, I still get it wrong. I still misgender people. I still make mistakes. I still do apology B sometimes. I still use problematic language, you know, sometimes knowing it, sometimes not knowing it. Like, we all make mistakes. And I remember a big part of sort of my narrative in updating and changing my teachings throughout the years is things that happened to me. And it was about 2 years ago. It was right. COVID is still very real. COVID is still very happening. So I'm not saying it was when COVID was still active, because it is right now, and it's impacting so many people.
Yeah.
But it was right post at least the sort of lockdown period of COVID.
Yeah.
And I went to the grocery store, and the grocery store had like this giant panel of like plexiglass by the cashier and the sort of like conveyor belt to where folks put groceries, right? So I'm checking out, and there's a person in front of me, and I'm going to use her pronouns, because I later find out those are her pronouns. But her groceries are getting checked out by the cashier. I'm putting my groceries on the little conveyor belt, and cashier finishes checking this person out, and the person is struggling to pay. And so there's like a pause. There's like a bottleneck in front of me.
I see.
And unbeknownst to me, the cashier is moving that little conveyor belt of all my stuff, and it reaches sort of like the register. Mm-hmm. And this person, she reaches around the plexiglass, grabs my groceries, and like shoves them back. And I just like was like, what are you doing? Like, what is happening right now? And instinctually, without thinking, I just like look at her red face and I go, excuse me, ma'am. And I'm just like, gender this person as a weapon. I'm like, excuse me, ma'am. And I'm like, I have been doing this for over a decade.
Yeah.
And instantly in a grocery store, I throw away all my own teachings and I decide to gender someone in a weaponized manner immediately without thinking. And what was so, I don't want to say good, because it was a harmful situation that took place. What was so brilliant about it is that this person, by all intents and purposes, doesn't work in the field, is not aware of these educations and these teachings, knew it immediately, knew it by the language, by the tone of voice, and they looked at me from head to toe like someone who is gender nonconforming, who had makeup on, who was wearing a dress, but also has facial hair, and like weaponized it and throwed it right back. And was like, excuse me, ma'am. No, excuse me, sir. And just like threw it right back in my face.
Wow.
And there was just this like an amazing awareness of, one, anyone can make mistakes, including me.
Yeah.
Two, I think anybody is capable, whether they're in this field or not, whether they're like trying to work on language or not, to know when something is weaponized and thrown at them.
Yes.
And then also has the capacity to do it back.
Yeah.
And it was just this like aha moment for me.
Yeah.
And you know, what I did was I apologized. I said, gosh, I'm so sorry. I'm just very nervous. I have a weakened immune system. So when you reached around, I just sort of reacted.
Yeah.
I'm so sorry. And the person was like, I understand that, but like, I'm having trouble cashing out. And then sort of like went into sort of XYZ explanation of her finances and how things weren't so good. And she was having a moment.
Yeah.
And instead of like allowing for grace, allowing for patience, I just like ran in there and threw something at her, you know? And so we had a conversation around it. We joked about it after. I was buying ho-hos for some reason. And I was like, hands off my ho-hos. And it was just like a funny way to like end it. But it's just, I always go back to that story. And I'm not a politician. That is a true story. Like, that legit happened. And I just always go back to that as an example of, like, even I make mistakes. And what is important to do is to not be defensive about it, is to not justify it or excuse it, but to lean into it, to lean into that comfortable nature of, like, yeah, I messed up. I'm really sorry that I did that. And she was like, you know, they used to call my mom, ma'am. It makes me feel old. It doesn't feel good to me, you know? And so it was just like, yeah, wow. Again, I make mistakes, but like a lot of people get the concept of how certain words don't feel honoring, even from and sort of like older generation who maybe grew up more socialized than maybe some of us are now, or at least trying to change that. And it was just very powerful. So that story just sort of like reminds me of like what it means to try, what it means to do actions, and what it means to also allow yourself grace. And if even I'm messing up, it's okay for you to mess up. Just work on it and try.
Thank you so much for sharing that, because I feel like it's so important to understand that, you know, we're all human and we do, you know, have tendencies sometimes. All of us, even the best intentioned people, have tendencies sometimes to say things out of, you know, an emotional response, right? Like you're coming out of this from a place that is not necessarily tethered to your best intentions always. And it just, it's part of being human. So I really appreciate you sharing that, because I feel like it's an important lesson for people and an important example for people to understand that even if you're going to approach this and that you do accidentally make a mistake, as long as you're being intentional with how you respond to that and how you move forward through that and take it as a lesson learned instead of apologizing and not moving forward with the lesson learned, I think that that's such a powerful way to move into the next steps. And I think that it, this iterative type of building block will allow eventually for there to be significantly less problems, right? Like significantly less slip-ups, and your behavior will eventually change, but it's a process. And I think that, you know, I love how you shared, you know, you've been doing it for a decade and you still pulled it out of the bag just like that, you know? And it's like, I mean, it's amazing how things sometimes just stick in your brain in ways that we don't fully understand. So I think what a good example for people to kind of leave this conversation with and to move forward to say they'll have a little grace in this work as they move forward. So, well, this has been great, Tay. You know, is there anything else you want to mention to the people listening before we sign off?
I mean, I'll just say, like, I do this work because I'm deeply, deeply passionate about it. It's like everything that I am. And I just like really appreciate the folks who showed up, who participated, who, you know, maybe went and rewatched one or watched one of the ones that they missed. And I just say it's really an honor to have done this series. And yeah, and thank you. Like, thank you all for letting me come in and do this. It was really a pleasure.
Yeah, absolutely. And thank you so much for not only working with us in this capacity to develop this webinar and help folks out, but also to, you know, come on here and have a deeper conversation about the substance matter of the work and to share some of your experiences and stories. I think it's absolutely critical to the work moving forward and helps, you know, people listening to this podcast and using the webinar as a tool in profound ways. So thank you so much, Tay.
Yeah. Thank you, Jared.
That concludes this two-part conversation with Arc Talos St. Amour about the recent webinar series they made for us titled Decolonizing the History of the Gender Binary. We at the Center for Tribes hope you enjoyed this great conversation, and I just want to add a quick reminder that all content and tools discussed in this episode will be listed in the show notes and are available on our website, www.tribalinformationexchange.org. Thanks again for joining us, and I hope you have a great day.